Muni, a New York physician who recently started an amazing program. Unlimited doctor's appointments to anyone who wanted them for just $79 per month. His logic was simple. If he could avoid the mountains of paperwork that come with insurance, he could cut his costs and make sure healthcare was within reach of everyone. That's when government stepped in. You see, despite the speeches from politicians, the government doesn't really care if you're able to see a doctor. What they care about is control. The state insurance department told Dr. Muni that he had to stop offering his low-cost, fixed-rate plan because it was too similar to insurance. To put it another way, a doctor's effort to avoid the hassles of insurance could continue only if he started his own health insurance company. In the middle of the controversy, I brought Dr. Muni on the air to talk about it. After his appearance, the state told him that they would allow him to continue with a modified version of his plan, one that would, unfortunately, cover less and cost more. As Dr. Muni said, "I really don't want to charge more. They're forcing me." While the situation is still far from optimal, the truth is that his entire plan would have been destroyed if it weren't for people all around America standing up and showing their outrage. That is why, despite how exhausting it is, we must continue arguing with every idiot at every opportunity. When our freedoms aren't our focus, our country becomes dangerously ill. Our founders might not have been doctors, but they still outlined the proper prescription to keep America healthy and vibrant, a common-sense approach focusing on rights and responsibilities. Now, take the two of those and call Washington in the morning.
Chapter 12, The U.S. Constitution, Lost in Translation. How many times have you argued with your idiot friends about what's constitutional and what isn't? You may even show them the Constitution, but the disagreement continues. That made me think that maybe the problem is that the entire Constitution is written in English. Yeah, it's a language very difficult for the average idiot to comprehend. In addition, there are several words in the document longer than three letters, making it tougher to read than Dick and Jane books. Wait a minute, those are also four-letter words. What follows is a translation, from English to idiot, of several important parts of the U.S. Constitution, leaving no doubt as to what our founding fathers really intended.
On July 24th, 1787, delegates established a committee of detail to generate a rough draft of the Constitution, synergizing their debates. The preamble of their first draft read as follows.
We, the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Providence Plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, do ordain, declare, and establish the following Constitution for the government of ourselves and our posterity.
Then on September 8th, the Committee of Style was established to refine and revise the articles that had been agreed upon. After 4 days of work, they presented a digest version of the Constitution that included this new preamble.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
Over 22 decades later, it has become easy for us to forget that the 3 million or so inhabitants of the country at the time considered themselves to be citizens of their own state first, and only then a citizen of the country. It was a far more localized environment, meaning that unifying the various states under the banner of the United States was a revolutionary way of thinking.
Article 1, Section 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives.
Notice that it isn't the Supreme Court that's granted the right to make laws. Shocking.
Section 2. The House of Representatives shall be composed of members chosen every second year by the people of the several states, and the electors in each state shall have the qualifications requisite for electors of the most numerous branch of the state legislature.
In retrospect, a term limit clause might not have been a bad idea here. Say, 2 or 3 terms max. In Federalist Paper No. 53, James Madison, who also authored the majority of the Constitution, wrote, "A few of the members, as happens in all such assemblies, will possess superior talents, will by frequent re-elections become members of long standing, will be thoroughly masters of the public business, and perhaps not unwilling to avail themselves of those advantages. The greater the proportion of new members of Congress, and the less the information of the bulk of the members, the more apt they be to fall into the snares that may be laid before them." Madison seemed to favor experience and know-how, but perhaps time has proven that he may have given our politicians far too much rope with which to hang themselves. He may have also assumed that people like Strom Thurmond and Robert Byrd would have the good sense to retire before reaching their early hundreds. Or maybe he just didn't count on people living as long as they do now. After all, the life expectancy of someone born in Philadelphia from 1754 to 1790 was just 13 years.
No person shall be a senator who shall not have attained to the age of 30 years, and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen.
I think Walmart greeters have stricter hiring guidelines than we do.
Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding to the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons.
Idiots point to this as proof that the founders were racist Klansmen who wore powdered wigs instead of white sheets. But nothing could be farther from the truth. This whole section deals with counting Americans, a census, for the purpose of representation. It does not deal with placing value on human life. Many of the founders actually wanted to eliminate slavery, but knew they couldn't push for it right away and still keep the Union together. For instance, in the 1790 census, which took place 3 years after the ratification of the Constitution, the slave population of South Carolina alone was 77% of the white population. By 1820, slaves outnumbered whites 265,000 to 237,000, give or take, and by 1860, the slave population had grown to over 412,000 compared to just 291,000 for whites. Georgia and Virginia also had an enormous number of slaves. By including the slave population in the census on a one-to-one basis, the South would have had all the representation it needed to outvote the North on the slavery issue indefinitely. So, in order to keep the representation of the South down, thereby keeping the elimination of slavery on the table, the Founding Fathers devised this counting method to limit the power the South could wield, thus ensuring that one day this new nation would be able to abolish slavery. For example, Gouverneur Morris, who assisted James Madison throughout the entire process of drafting the Constitution and was on the committee that decided on its final draft, described slavery as a nefarious institution, the curse of heaven on states where it prevailed. He also argued that congressional representation should be based on one for every 40,000 free inhabitants. As a vehement opponent of slavery, Morris opposed the 3/5 compromise because he felt it would still allow the Southern states enough representatives to keep slavery going indefinitely. Founders like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson are often described by critics as hypocrites when it comes to slavery. Yes, Washington and Jefferson both owned slaves, but both also opposed the slave trade. Is that hypocrisy? Well, let's think of it in modern-day terms. 200 years from now, if people decide that hiring illegal aliens is immoral, will all those who currently have their lawns mowed or children cared for by people who lack documentation be looked back on as racist hypocrites? Maybe, and it will certainly be easy to make those accusations, but no one is making them now, and that's exactly how it was in the late 18th century. So, were the founders who opposed slavery but acquiesced to the Three-Fifths Clause heroes or hypocrites? Here are some of their actual thoughts on slavery. Decide for yourself.
James Madison. Great as the evil of slavery is, a dismemberment of the Union would be worse. George Washington. There is not a man living who wishes more sincerely than I do to see a plan adopted for the abolition of slavery. John Adams. Every measure of prudence, therefore, ought to be assumed for the eventual total extirpation of slavery from the United States. I have, through my whole life, held the practice of slavery in abhorrence. Benjamin Franklin. Slavery is an atrocious debasement of human nature. Alexander Hamilton. The laws of certain states give an ownership in the service of Negroes as personal property. But, being men, by the laws of God and nature, they were capable of acquiring liberty, and when the captor in war thought it fit to give them liberty, the gift was not only valid, but irrevocable.
Idiots who argue with our founders' compromise have no concept of how important this nation was and still is. But our founders knew. They had such a clear understanding of what they were creating that they knew it would be better to establish an imperfect union rather than risk having the great American experiment fail before it ever got started.
Section 3. The Senate of the United States shall be composed of 2 senators from each state, chosen by the legislature thereof, for 6 years, and each senator shall have 1 vote.
It's amazing how many seemingly anti-democratic provisions can be found in the Constitution, but it was all by design. This section directed that senators were to be elected by state legislatures, not the people. Why? 2 reasons. First, the founders felt that creating a direct connection between state governments and the federal government would help the document to be ratified, and 2, they wanted senators to be able to vote their conscience without worrying about pandering to specific groups of voters. Unfortunately, it didn't work out the way they'd hoped. Instead of special interest groups fighting among themselves, state legislators began to fight each other, resulting in postponed elections and, ultimately, empty Senate seats. The process was eventually changed by the 17th Amendment, which, after being ratified in 1913, ensured senators were elected directly by the people. Unfortunately, they once again left out anything about term limits.
No person shall be a senator who shall not have obtained the age of 30 years, and been 9 years a citizen of the United States, and who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of that state for which he shall be chosen.
2 senators per state, each serving 6-year terms. A senator has to be 30 years old, a citizen for 9 years, and a resident of the state in which he or she is elected. What's not mentioned, a senator may grow up in Illinois, attend a college in Connecticut, move to Arkansas with her husband, move on to Washington, D.C., and then claim to have been a Yankee fan her whole life in order to get elected in New York State. Another loose interpretation would be that a senator could go to a party, drive an Oldsmobile into a river, leave his 19-year-old female companion, who happens not to be his wife, inside the car, go home, sit there for around 9 hours before finally calling police, and still be reelected to a Senate seat for the next 40-plus years.
The Vice President of the United States shall be President of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be equally divided.
At all other times, he'll be sequestered in an undisclosed location kept from the view of the citizenry. Until his term is over, then you won't be able to get rid of him.
Section 6. No senator or representative shall, during the time for which he was elected, be appointed to any civil office under the authority of the United States which shall have been created, or the emoluments whereof shall have been increased during such time, and no person holding any office under the United States shall be a member of either house during his continuance in office.
This shows the amazing foresight of our founders. They went to great lengths to limit the ways in which the system and, by default, the people in that system could become corrupted. As many people have noticed, the emoluments, i.e. salary, for the Secretary of State were increased during Clinton's most recent Senate term. That made her constitutionally ineligible to be appointed to that office. But since Congress didn't like the outcome, they simply changed the rules of the game. By using the Saxby fix, named after William Saxby, whose appointment to Attorney General by Republican President Richard Nixon was also unconstitutional, Congress was able to revert the salary for the Secretary of State position back to the level it was before Clinton's latest term. That fix allegedly made her eligible for the position. But I think our founders would disagree, especially considering there wasn't exactly any ambiguity in their wording of this section. Besides Clinton and Saxby, this clause was also violated by Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton with their appointments of Ed Muskie as Secretary of State and Lloyd Benson as Treasury Secretary, respectively. To those who care about both the letter and spirit of our laws, the Saxby fix is an abomination. You can't change history by passing a bill. If you don't like the emoluments clause or believe it needs to be better defined, then use the tools our founders gave us by passing a constitutional amendment.
Section 7. Every order, resolution, or vote to which the concurrence of the Senate and the House of Representatives may be necessary, except on a question of adjournment, shall be presented to the President of the United States, and before the same shall take effect, shall be approved by him, or being disapproved by him, shall be repassed by 2/3 of the Senate and the House of Representatives, according to the rules and limitations prescribed in the case of a bill.
Notice that there is nothing in here about the presidential practice of signing statements, which are pronouncements made by a president upon signing a bill, used to detail some specific issue the president has with it. In some cases, a signing statement can actually modify a bill's intent. It's a practice that has been employed by presidents going all the way back to James Monroe, but it was used extensively by Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, who expressed opposition to 1,200 items over his two terms and has continued under Barack Obama. The Supreme Court has never directly ruled on this practice, but the Constitution makes a president's options very clear. Veto a bill or faithfully execute the laws. Signing statements attempt to carve out middle ground where none was meant to exist.
Section 8. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States.
Here's what's not in Section 8. Congress shall also have the power to retaliate against executives at AIG, a company that will one day be founded, grow extremely large, fall on hard times, receive a government bailout, be allowed by Congress to give bonuses to their executives anyway, then have them taken away via a 90% tax levy. Congress shall also have the power to level the playing field by imposing extraordinary taxes against successful people and shall at all times endeavor to redistribute wealth to the less fortunate.
To borrow money on the credit of the United States.
Congress seems to have no problem following this clause.
To regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes.
It's amazing how one small word can change everything. In this case, it's among. The Constitution allows the federal government to regulate commerce among the states, not within them. But that line in the sand is long gone, as are states' rights. If we're serious about returning America to the principles laid out in this document, then it all starts by getting the federal government out of things they don't belong in. Fortunately, people are finally beginning to understand that. See the 10th Amendment for one effort that's underway. By the way, I wonder if we owe as much to the Indian tribes as we do to China.
To establish a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform laws on the subject of bankruptcies throughout the United States.
Uniform means always the same, a concept that was shredded when the federal government single-handedly chose which companies would survive and which ones would fail.
To coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries.
Barack, restore science to its rightful place, Obama, is definitely a fan of this section, though I wonder if someone should tell him that our founders were actually referring to patents and copyrights.
To define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the law of nations.
Turned out to be the Navy SEALs, not Congress, that punished a group of pirates on the high seas.
To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions.
A good question to ask your idiot friend is, what was the first insurrection put down by a militia called forth by Congress? Very likely, you'll get a blank stare back. An extra idiotic idiot might claim it was the Tea Parties of 2009, when a bunch of rich people financed by the GOP got together to complain about the president. At least, that's what you were told happened if you listened to the mainstream media. But the New Republic's first insurrection following ratification of the Constitution was actually started by whiskey drinkers and producers. I know, drunks getting into a fight. Shocking. In 1791, a tax on whiskey was imposed to help pay for the Revolutionary War. 6 cents per gallon for large whiskey producers and 9 cents per gallon for small producers. Of course, the tax not only affected farmers, but also those who drank the whiskey. By 1794, the tension created by this tax gave rise to an armed rebellion, which was quickly extinguished by a U.S. Army force of over 13,000, led by President George Washington himself. No shots were ever fired. This is a perfect illustration of what eventually happens when the federal government becomes oppressive and non-responsive to the will of the people. In 1803, the government got the message and repealed the whiskey tax. Will they get the message this time?
To provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers, and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress.
Obama Subarticle 1A. We also need a civilian force just as strong, just as powerful, and just as well-funded as the military. Since our founders were obviously not insightful enough to provide this. Also, let's not forget 3 months of mandatory voluntary service for all 18 to 25-year-olds.
Section 9. The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person.
That's right. The founders actually put a price tag on coming to this country, $10 per person. Apparently, they felt like there was a value to being able to live here. Not anymore. These days, we can't ask anything of immigrants, including that they abide by our laws.
The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended, unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it.
See? There it is. The smoking gun. You can't suspend habeas corpus ever under any... Wait, what? You can suspend habeas corpus when the public safety may require it? Wow. I guess this document is a little more accurate than the blogs, huh?
No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed.
Attainder isn't exactly an everyday word, so allow me to quote Justice Hugo Black's interpretation of it from a 1946 case, U.S. versus Lovett. Legislative acts, no matter what their form, that apply either to named individuals or to easily ascertainable members of a group in such a way as to inflict punishment on them without a judicial trial, are bills of attainder prohibited by the Constitution. Now, I'm no constitutional scholar, but I am a thinker. Wouldn't the law that Congress tried to pass targeting the bonuses of certain executives, primarily from AIG, fit that definition almost exactly?
No money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law, and a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time.
From time to time apparently means that we get to see an account of those receipts once every 250 years. Maybe they've used up all the available paper to print money?
No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of Congress, accept of any present, emolument, office, or title of any kind whatever from any king, prince, or foreign state.
I believe this would also include the titles of Messiah, Chosen One, All-Powerful Potentate, and Savior of the Universe. It's too bad they didn't include a provision for the unfortunate gifts given to other heads of state. That oversight means that the 25 DVDs that were incompatible with European standards and couldn't be played, President Obama gave to UK Prime Minister Gordon Brown, are apparently not unconstitutional.
Section 10. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, or grant any title of nobility.
Ex post facto means after the fact, so the intent of this seems pretty clear, right? Hey, states, no retroactive laws! Unfortunately, the Supreme Court didn't see it that way. In their infinite wisdom, they decided that the clause doesn't pertain to taxes. Don't be surprised if states take advantage of that. Connecticut and New York already tried by attempting to retroactively increase tax rates or retroactively create new ones.
Article 2, Section 1. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, be elected as follows.
Wait, I'm still looking for the part specifying the power of the president shall also extend to him serving as the CEO of GM, Chrysler, Citi, Wachovia, Bear Stearns, AIG, etc. It must come later. I'll keep looking.
In case of the removal of the president from office, or of his death, resignation, or inability to discharge the powers and duties of the said office, the same shall devolve onto the vice president, and the Congress may by law provide for the case of removal, death, resignation, or inability, both of the president and vice president, declaring what officer shall then act as president, and such officer shall act accordingly, until the disability be removed, or a president shall be elected.
Want a chill to run down your spine? Here's the current presidential line of succession. Number 1, Vice President Joe Biden. Yes, the same guy who's been eating regularly at Katie's Restaurant in downtown Wilmington, even though it's been out of business since the 80s. Number 2, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. This has you praying hard for the health and well-being of the president and vice president, doesn't it? Number 3, President pro tempore of the Senate, Robert Byrd. Not just the former grand poobah of the KKK, but also approximately 4,892 years old. On the plus side, his ascension to president would make an easy case for congressional term limits. Number 4, Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton. It would take a village to die for her to get in, but it would somehow be fitting if, after being rejected by her own party, she got into the Oval Office without ever winning an election. Number 5, Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner, Mr. TurboTax, Mr. I'm quite open to one world currency. Number 6, Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. So far, I'll take him. Number 7, Attorney General Eric Holder. America is a nation of cowards. Number 8, Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar. Who? Number 9, Secretary of Agriculture, Tim Vilsack. Who? Number 10, Secretary of Commerce Gary Locke. No clue. Number 11, Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis, an open borders, pro-amnesty, pro-big labor leftist whose nomination was opposed in committee by just two Republicans. Two. At least she's 11th in line.
The president shall, at stated times, receive for his services a compensation, which shall neither be increased nor diminished during the period for which he shall have been elected, and he shall not receive within that period any other emolument from the United States or any of them.
Presidential compensation started out at $25,000. The president's current compensation is $400,000. Or about what the third-string right fielder for the Toronto Blue Jays makes. I believe the current president is also about as qualified as the third-string right fielder for the Toronto Blue Jays.
Article 3, Section 1. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may, from time to time, ordain and establish. The judges, both of the Supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior, and shall, at stated times, receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office.
Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been running around talking about why international law is okay to use as precedent when deciding Supreme Court rulings. That's good behavior? In a speech given at Ohio State, Ginsburg asked, "Why shouldn't we look to the wisdom of a judge from abroad with at least as much ease as we would read a law review article written by a professor?" Well, maybe because of the oath of office she took when she became a Supreme Court justice.
"I, name, do solemnly swear or affirm that I will administer justice without respect to persons, and do equal right to the poor and to the rich, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform all the duties incumbent upon me as, title, under the Constitution and laws of the United States, so help me God."
That's interesting. The Constitution and laws of the United States, huh? No mention of Germany, France, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, or Rwanda. Weird. Chief Justice John Roberts puts it this way: "If we're relying on a decision from a German judge about what our Constitution means, no president accountable to the people appointed that judge and no Senate accountable to the people confirmed that judge. And yet he's playing a role in shaping the law that binds the people in this country." Maybe it's just me, but I'm thinking it might be time to redefine exactly what the Good Behavior Clause really means.
Section 3. Treason against the United States shall consist in only levying war against them, or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act, or on confession in open court.
It seems as though it's now nearly impossible to rise to the level of treason in this country. You can be an American citizen from, just as an example, California, and be carrying an AK-47 on a foreign battlefield, firing at U.S. troops, and when caught, the worst charge you're likely to face is jaywalking in a war zone. Rushing to his defense will be idiots with questions like, "What kind of childhood did he have? What drove him to do this? Did his teachers use red ink when they marked up his test papers? Did other children call him fatso or doofus at recess? Maybe he couldn't get a date for prom. Perhaps he had zits." When idiots factor in all of that, the perpetrator can't possibly be responsible for his treasonous actions. In fact, it's our fault. American society is to blame. Forget what the Constitution says. Those men in powder wigs had no idea how complex our culture would eventually become. The penalty for treason is no longer death. It's government-sponsored therapy.
Article 4. A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall on demand of executive authority of the state from which he fled be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime.
We take all of this unity among states for granted because, due to the wisdom of our founders, it's been ingrained in our society for over 200 years, but things didn't start out that way. New Yorkers had no tolerance for the ways of Virginians, who in turn were leery of people from Massachusetts, etc. But now we're all one big happy family. Void in Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, California, and all other states where idiotic ideology has taken root.
Section 3. New states may be admitted by the Congress into this Union, but no new states shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of another state, nor any state be formed by the junction of two or more states, or parts of states, without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned, as well as of the Congress.
This has me very concerned about the 57 states mentioned by then-candidate Obama during his election campaign. Were those widely unknown seven states admitted by the Congress? He also mentioned that he had one left to go, which would make 58, plus he hadn't visited Alaska or Hawaii yet. Are there, in fact, 60 states? If so, did Congress formally admit all 10? I demand answers!
Article 6. All debts contracted and engagements entered into before the adoption of this Constitution shall be as valid against the United States under this Constitution as under the Confederation.
So, we decided to honor our contracts even though we were going through a time of massive change? Wow, someone should tell Congress.
This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made, or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or laws of any state, to the contrary, notwithstanding.
This is the article that makes many people so uneasy with the UN. The idiots in your life probably know nothing more about the UN than their trick-or-treat for UNICEF campaign. They don't pay attention to things like the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which could give some international body of experts control over education, or the Law of the Sea Treaty, which could give the UN control over U.S. territorial waters. Ask any mermaid you happen to see, what's the worst treaty? Treaty of the Sea.
Bill of Rights. First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances.
That doesn't seem so hard to understand, does it? There's no problem, as long as Congress doesn't make a law that tells Americans that Frisbeterianism, the belief that, you know, when you die, your soul goes up on the roof and you can't get it back down, like a frisbee, is the official state religion to which all people must belong, or pass a law that prohibits us from worshiping or not worshiping. Given that straightforward definition, why are your idiot friends always screaming, separation of church and state? Maybe you should ask them to point out those five words to you in this document. They're not there. That phrase was actually contained in a letter written by Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1802, 15 years after the Constitution was written. The Danbury Baptists were a minority religious group that feared that they had no inalienable right granted them by the state of Connecticut to worship as they chose. Instead, they felt they were allowed to worship only as a favor granted to them by the state. So they wrote to President Jefferson, seeking his guidance and comfort, that they could continue to worship as they would. Jefferson responded with the exact words from the Constitution to allay their fears. He then mentioned the Establishment Clause created a wall of separation between church and state. Aha! The smoking gun! Actually, no. If you read the letter, Jefferson's clear meaning was that religions were protected from the state, not the other way around. The legitimate powers of government, he told them, reach actions only and not opinions. You'll also notice that there is no mention of constitutional protection from being offended. If a person is offended by a religious display on government property, a nativity scene, for example, tough. We're all sorry for you, but we have every confidence that you'll get over it. If not, no, well, there's always France.
Second Amendment. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
Here's a loose translation. If you break into my house in the middle of the night, you'll be shot dead. I won't be yelling, "Do anything you want with my wife and kids, but leave me alone, please!" A much more academic translation, along with a long response to idiots who like to talk about our founders' use of grammar, can be found in our Second Amendment chapter.
Third Amendment. No soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house, without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law.
This one hasn't really come up much recently, but I'm sure next time it does, we'll have plenty of activist groups trying to keep soldiers away by debating the location of the comma. In the meantime, should a soldier knock on your door and ask for a room, please call your nearby constitutional lawyer for immediate assistance.
Fourth Amendment. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue, but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched, and the persons or things to be seized.
At this point, your idiot friend is likely screaming, "George Bush's warrantless wiretapping program!" I don't know of a single American citizen who's never had a conversation with an Osama wannabe in some musty cave in Pakistan that's actually been affected by this program. And neither does your idiot friend. Oh, and by the way, Barack Obama has not only defended the Bush program, he's broadened the government's legal argument for it. The founders worded this much more eloquently than we do. We just call it double jeopardy or the OJ clause. Unfortunately for OJ, the framers never mentioned anything about not being convicted for a completely unrelated crime and then having the mistaken verdict from your first trial used against you in the second.
Fifth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces, or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life and limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation.
Thus the familiar refrain, "I take the fifth." That doesn't mean the person is asking for a fifth of whiskey, though many people who take the fifth could certainly use a fifth at that point. It means that he is claiming his right to not bear witness against himself, granted to him by this clause, the Fifth Amendment. This simple term was actually the result of much debate among the founders. After seeing the lack of respect that the tyrannical British government had for private property, they wanted to include language to ensure that wouldn't happen here, but they disagreed on the exact wording. Some wanted to use the term public purpose or public benefit, a concept that would have made it much easier to seize property. "Hey there, Joe. Sorry, but we're going to need your land to build a new Department of Motor Vehicles." James Madison struck a compromise with the far more restrictive term public use and also included just compensation for victims of what we now call eminent domain. Of course, the debate among our founders turned out to be pointless given the recent Supreme Court decision that allowed a Connecticut city to seize private property just so they could make money by selling it to a developer. Madison must be rolling over in his grave.
Sixth Amendment. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed. which districts shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense.
With our court system so jammed up with frivolous lawsuits, it's only a matter of time before the slanket sues the snuggie. The right to a speedy trial is somewhat subjective. I would also argue that the whole public aspect has really been run through the shredder. I think our founders would be quite disappointed to find out that we have high-def TVs hanging on walls, broadcasting live feeds from around the world, and we still have to fight to get cameras into the courtroom.
Seventh Amendment. In suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of a trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law.
Since our founders could never have known the insane rate at which we'd be coining money, they probably also didn't realize the effect that inflation would have on the value of a dollar. That's a likely reason why the $20 wasn't indexed for inflation. But if we're looking for the original intent, the value of $20 back in 1787 was, well, who knows, because the Bureau of Labor Statistics wasn't even created until the late 1800s. But given that $20 in 1913 would be worth $432 today, you can guess that the founders didn't intend every jaywalking ticket to be decided by a jury.
Eighth Amendment. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted.
While some of our founders, like Thomas Jefferson, insisted on a Bill of Rights, others did not want to include them in the Constitution for fear that if certain rights were specified, then the people could be denied other rights that were not specifically listed. This amendment was the agreed-upon compromise.
Tenth Amendment. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people.
This is a profound and critical amendment, widely ignored by the federal government. Everything that is not specifically spelled out here, abortion, for example, is decided by the states. Instead, the federal government has unconstitutionally overstepped its boundaries in almost every possible way. They're so far over the line that it will be difficult, if not impossible, to ever rein them back in. But one state is trying anyway. Montana recently passed a bill asserting that guns manufactured in Montana and sold in Montana to people who intend to keep their weapons in Montana are exempt from all federal gun regulations, including registration requirements, background check, and dealer licensing rules. Why? Because Article 1, Section 3 gives the federal government the right to regulate commerce only between states, not within them. While this bill is specifically written to pertain to firearms, it's really about the much larger concept of states' rights. It's a gun bill, said Democratic Governor Brian Schweitzer, but it's another way of demonstrating the sovereignty of the state of Montana. It's also a sign of hope. This bill is being crafted specifically to pick a fight with the federal government, a fight that I believe is long overdue. The theory goes that once someone from Montana attempts to exercise their rights under this legislation, a federal agency will intervene. At that point, a lawsuit would be filed that, since the case involves the constitutionality of a law, could make it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. If that happens, and if the Supreme Court were to rule in favor of Montana, Scalia, Thomas, Alito, Roberts, Kennedy, but you better act fast, it would be a major victory for state rights, and one that could extend far beyond guns to virtually every aspect of our lives. Texas and Alaska have similar laws pending, but more states have to get on the bandwagon if this is ever to succeed as a national issue. Even with enough Supreme Court justices seemingly open to reestablishing state rights, they're not going to take this argument lightly. In 2005, they ruled in favor of the federal government being able to regulate marijuana grown and used in California. That means any new effort will have to navigate through the faults of California's attempt and present a clear, cohesive, and compelling case that the federal government has needlessly overstepped its bounds. If that happens, and that's a Montana-sized if, We may have finally found the kryptonite that can be used against the progressives' relentless attack on this document.
13th Amendment, Section 1. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States, or any place subject to their jurisdiction.
It took 78 years and the deaths of 618,000 people during the Civil War, including deaths due to disease, but the long effort to abolish the blight of slavery had finally ended. Article 1, Section 9 had allowed 20 years of further slave trade, a length of time that many founders hoped would be sufficient for the South to wean itself from the horrendous practice. But even after the importation of new slaves stopped in 1808, the South was so dependent upon slavery that it was unwilling to let it go. Sound a little like businesses relying on illegal immigration today? Thus, it became necessary to end slavery by expending unthinkable amounts of blood and treasure.
14th Amendment, Section 1. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws.
Perhaps no amendment has been twisted and turned as much as this one. The Birthright Citizenship Clause was originally meant to ensure that children of freed slaves would be American citizens. Of course, we don't really have that problem anymore, so here's the 21st century revision.
All persons who successfully sneak into the country will be allowed to stay indefinitely. All crimes committed by those lawbreakers, i.e. identity theft, fraud, and tax evasion, shall be ignored. These non-American Americans will be afforded free health care at emergency rooms, free education, and special in-state tuition deals at colleges not afforded legal citizens. All children born of these lawbreakers shall immediately become citizens of the United States. Any persons attempting to thwart this revision of Section 1 will be labeled racists, hate mongers, xenophobes, and all around bad people. Section 3. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, but Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each House, remove such disability.
Does shaking hands with and accepting books from our enemies give them comfort? If so, then this section should be looked at a little more closely.
15th Amendment, Section 1. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
Oops! They forgot age. See Article 26. It only took 101 years to fix that.
16th Amendment. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes on incomes, from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census or enumeration.
It was President Woodrow Wilson who finally got the progressive income tax passed. Of course, his rhetoric would sound nothing like that of today's politicians, right? You decide. Here are Wilson's words from an address he gave in 1913.
You are here in order to enable the world to live more amply, with greater vision, with a finer spirit of hope and achievement. You are here to enrich the world.
Such was the rhetoric of the new progressives in America as they began their campaign of social justice and equity in our country, all for the greater good. Naturally, only the meanest, most evil 1% of wage earners would be affected by this new income tax, so 99% of the country didn't need to worry, at least until it was expanded a couple of decades later.
22nd Amendment, Section 1. No person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of the president more than once. But this article shall not apply to any person holding the office of president when this article was proposed by the Congress, and shall not prevent any person who may be holding the office of president or acting as president during the term within which this article becomes operative from holding the office of president or acting as president during the remainder of such term.
It's interesting that this amendment was proposed just 2 years and ratified 6 years after the death of FDR, a president who was allegedly so beloved that he was elected to 4 terms. I guess we loved him so much that we wanted to make sure no one would ever stay in office that long again. Makes sense. One interesting side note, Harry Truman was specifically excluded from this amendment. He could have run for a 3rd term, but wisely chose not to.
24th Amendment, Section 1. The right of citizens of the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president, for electors for president or vice president, or for senator or representative in Congress, shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay poll tax or other tax.
Younger Americans probably skip right past this amendment, but it was actually pretty important and controversial. Around the turn of the 20th century, several states, unhappy about the end of slavery, instituted poll taxes as a way of keeping African Americans out of the voting booth. By the time 1962 came around, 5 states, Alabama, Arkansas, Mississippi, Virginia, and Texas, still use the taxes as a means of discrimination. This amendment made federal poll taxes a crime, and state taxes were also outlawed under the Equal Protection Clause. But it had a hard time getting out of the Senate. Southern Democrats, intent on keeping the amendment from coming up for a vote, filibustered for 10 straight days. Then, according to one account, they ran out of words. The Senate jumped into action. But since the wording of the amendment was stuck in the Judiciary Committee, headed by a senator from poll tax-friendly Mississippi, they had to rely on an old political trick instead. After the filibuster ended, Florida conservative Spessard Holland introduced a resolution to make Alexander Hamilton's former home a national monument. Once it was approved, Holland then moved to exchange the proposed language of the 24th Amendment with the Hamilton Resolution. That passed as well, and the final vote was a landslide. The amendment was ratified by the states 514 days later. Though Mississippi stuck to its guns, it was the only state to outright reject it.
25th Amendment, Section 1. In case of the removal of the president from office, or of his death or resignation, the vice president shall become president.
Joe Biden was actually 25 years old when this amendment, precipitated by the assassination of JFK, was ratified. If they only knew then what we know now.
26th Amendment, Section 1. The right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years of age or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of age.
Does that mean we can deny them on account of stupidity?
Oh, you gotta love the idiots.
Arguing with Idiots, How to Stop Small Minds and Big Government, was written and edited by Glenn Beck and Kevin Bell, and read by Glenn Beck, Steve Stu Pergear, and Pat Gray. It was recorded at the studios of Mercury Radio in New York by Paul Fowley and Mike DeCino. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. It was mixed by Common Mode. Arguing with Idiots. How to Stop Small Minds and Big Government was produced and directed by Karen D. Mattia. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Arguing with Idiots, How to Stop Small Minds and Big Government is available in hardcover from Threshold. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, An Inconvenient Book, America's March to Socialism, Glenn Beck's Common Sense, and The Christmas Sweater by Glenn Beck.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.